Well, it looks like everybody stayed. I appreciate that. You were talking about Alabama before, and talking my South Dakota background, I might tell you about a couple up in South Dakota there that in the middle of the 40 below zero weather, they decided that they were going to take a little vacation, and they were going to come down to Gulf Shores, Alabama. Could have just as easily been Galveston, I suppose, but or South Padre Island, but they were going to come and stay for a week in a luxury resort there at Gulf Shores. And the day before they were to leave, the wife got a message that she had to come in for a business meeting the next day. And since the tickets were already bought and everything, they decided that the husband would go down by himself and then she'd come down and join him the next day. So he came down and he checked into this beautiful resort in Gulf Shores, Alabama. First thing he did was to send an email message to his wife, but he got one digit wrong on her email address, and so instead it went to the widow of a South Dakota pastor whose husband had just died the day before. And she read the message and she shrieked and fainted, because here's what it said. Dearest wife, just checked in. Everything's set for your arrival tomorrow. Eternally yours, your faithful husband. P.S. Sure is hot down here. Well, it is hot in Alabama, just like it is here in Houston, but other than that, warm hearts and a good place to be. In Proverbs 29, verse 2, we read the words, "When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when the wicked beareth rule, the people mourn." I'd like to talk about some of those who were in authority at the time our nation was founded. And, well, I could go for hours and hours about their various testimonies, their various actions and the like. Obviously, we're limited to an hour or 55 minutes now, and I'll probably take a little time out of that even for question and answer afterward. But let's look at some of the statements of leading American political figures from that time with the hope of demonstrating that the overwhelming majority of them were, in fact, strong professing Christians. Now, I'm going to first of all talk about two who probably were not. And one of these is Ben Franklin. Now, Ben Franklin is a man that I think is, well, I almost have to say that it'd be impossible even for God to not like Ben Franklin, but we'll just have to see about that, I guess. But Ben Franklin was, in some respects, a watered-down Puritan. We associate him with Philadelphia, but he was actually raised in Boston. He was trained for the ministry at first. His boyhood pastor was Cotton Mather. And a lot of his sayings out of Poor Richard's Almanac, like a penny saved is a penny earned, and wealthy, healthy, wealthy, and wise, and so on, are really somewhat secularized versions of that old Puritan ethic. But when he was about 14 years old, he says, he began to read a book that somebody gave him to refute deism. And he says the book had the opposite effect. He said, as I read the book, it seemed to me that the arguments for deism were stronger than the arguments this book presented against it, so I became a deist. But that's age 14. By the time he reached the ripe old age of 21, he says, he had seen how many of the deists lived their lives, and he became convinced that even if deism was true, it shouldn't be emphasized. And Franklin had a very pragmatic attitude toward truth. He was more concerned with what worked than what was objectively true. And a lot of things happened between his youth and on to when he's 81 years of age and at the Constitutional Convention. A lot of things happen in between. One thing was this religious revival in America that we call the Great Awakening of the early 1740s. It was in this period of time that there had been something of a decline from the old Puritanism of the early founding fathers, the Pilgrims and the Puritans in New England. Excuse me, that shouldn't have gone on the tape, but I guess it did. But a lot of people will be surprised to find that when you look to Virginia and the southern colonies, their laws and their morality wasn't all that much different from that of New England. But at any rate, there was something of a slide away from the early Christian zeal as you move into the early 1700s. And sometimes we see this happen in a family. You know, you might have somebody who gets saved and he's really on fire for the Lord, maybe starts a church, and then his children are also zealous Christians and pillars of the church. Third generation comes along, and they're still in the church, and they profess to believe the right things, but the old zeal isn't really there at all. And by the time you get to the fourth generation, there isn't even a pretense of being Christian. And it doesn't always follow that pattern, but often it does. And something of that seemed to be happening in America. And in the early 1700s, there was a slide away from the earlier Christian zeal. But this slide seems to have been arrested by a revival that God began in America, the first Great Awakening. And there were preachers of this time like Jonathan Edwards in the New England colonies, and many liberal academics today will tell you that Jonathan Edwards is the greatest intellectual America ever produced. First work was published when he was 6 years of age. It was about insects, but absolutely brilliant mind. In the middle and southern colonies, preacher by the name of George Whitfield. Whitfield could speak to huge crowds, and you wonder how this was done. Ben Franklin one time made an estimate about Whitfield. He heard Whitfield preaching, and he calculated the size of the town square where he was preaching and how the square was filled with people. There were four streets leading into the town square, and calculated how many people could stand abreast there and how far back the crowd was extending. And he estimated that Whitfield was preaching to a crowd of over 30,000 people. Excuse me, is this microphone working okay? Can you hear me? They had a disease in those days called preacher's throat, and you can understand where it came from. Well, Franklin attended Whitfield's crusades. He was a good personal friend of Whitfield. He contributed to his crusades. He did his printing for him free of charge. Probably he never fully accepted Whitfield's doctrine, but as Franklin wrote about it, he saw marriages being restored. He saw drunks becoming sober. He saw sluffers becoming hard workers. He saw criminals going straight. He saw communities being turned around. And essentially, Franklin said, I'm not so much concerned about the objective truth of the doctrine. It works, and so I'm for it. He describes one occasion when he was at one of Whitfield's crusades, and here's how he describes it. He says that Whitfield was planning to solicit funds for establishing an orphanage in Georgia. And Franklin said, I did not disapprove of the design, but as Georgia was then destitute of materials and workmen, and it was proposed to send these from Philadelphia at great expense, I thought it would have been better to have the house built here and brought the children to it. This I advised, but he was resolute in his project, rejected my counsel, and therefore I refused to contribute. I happened soon after to attend one of his sermons, and in the course of it I perceived he intended to finish with a collection, and I silently resolved that he should get nothing from me. I had in my pocket a handful of copper money, three or four silver dollars, and five pistols of gold. As he proceeded, I began to soften and concluded to give the coppers. Another stroke of his oratory made me ashamed of that, and I determined to give the silver. And he finished so admirably that I emptied my pocket wholly into the collector's dish, gold and all. When we come to the War for Independence, Franklin worked so closely with particularly Calvinists at this time that he wrote after that that he said, "I want my grandson educated in Switzerland because I want him raised as a Presbyterian and a Republican." Presbyterian with a capital P, Republican with a small r. And as we get to the Constitutional Convention, it is Ben Franklin who stands up at the convention when they are in the midst of great discord over certain issues, and it is Franklin who stands up and makes the motion for daily prayer. And part of what he said is, and bear in mind what he talks about in this room, this is in Independence Hall, it's the same place where 11 years earlier they met for the Declaration of Independence, and he said, "In the beginning of the contest with Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayers in this room for the divine protection. Our prayers, sir, were heard, and they were graciously answered. I have lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men." Now, you don't have to be a Christian to believe God governs in the affairs of men, but that is as direct a repudiation of deism as Franklin could possibly make. And he goes on to say, "And if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel." That from one of the three least orthodox of the delegates to that convention. Several years later, Ezra Stiles, the president of Yale, and by the way, Harvard, Yale, and almost all of these early colleges in America were founded on the Bible and founded for the training of pastors. But Ezra Stiles, the president of Yale, wrote a letter to Franklin in which he asked his opinion concerning Jesus of Nazareth. Franklin answered, "As to Jesus of Nazareth, my opinion of whom you particularly desire, I think his system of morals and his religion as he left them to us the best the world ever saw or is likely to see." But then he goes on to say that he has some doubts as to his divinity. Now, a deist would say he has no doubts. He knows Jesus is not divine. But Franklin says he has some doubts. Now, I don't know what he means by that entirely. I'd always interpreted that to mean he had some doubts as to whether Jesus was divine. It could mean that he has some doubts as to the nature of Jesus' divinity, whether it's the Trinitarian formula or possibly the Arian formula that Jesus was the divine Son of God, but not fully equal with the Father and not co-eternal with the Father, or maybe the modalist view that Jesus and the Holy Spirit were just three different faces that one Father has. We don't really know for sure what he means by this, but he says that it is a question I do not dogmatize upon when I expect soon an opportunity of knowing the truth with less trouble. Well, I'm sure he knows the truth today. Earlier in his life, he had written an epitaph. It wasn't ever used on his tombstone, but here's what he said he wanted his epitaph to say, and here's, think of what this says about him. "The body of B. Franklin, printer, like the cover of an old book, its contents torn out and stripped of its lettering and gilding, lies here food for worms. But the work shall not be lost, for it will, as he believed, appear once more in a new and more elegant edition, revised and corrected by the author." Well, I hope Ben Franklin participates in that resurrection. Let me talk about, well, probably I should talk about Jefferson for a moment first. Jefferson is sometimes called a Christian. He does make the statement later in life that I am a real Christian. But he means that in the sense of one who follows the moral teachings of Jesus, not one who believes Jesus is the Son of God and Jesus who suffered as his substitute for his sins. Jefferson was a strong rationalist, believed so strongly in the power of human reason and the infallibility of logic that for him it was an absurdity to say that three could be one or one could be three, and therefore he rejected the doctrine of the Trinity and probably with it the divinity of Christ, although he rejected Jesus as a man. You'll hear it said about him that he wrote his own version of the Bible, the Jefferson Bible, as it is sometimes called. I would say that's not entirely correct. What he wrote actually was a compendium of Bible verses that he was recommending that people study. He never called it the Jeffersonian Bible, and I don't think it should be called that today. But I don't think Jefferson can be called a deist. Several statements that Jefferson makes that I think clearly show otherwise. One, for example, he says concerning slavery, that I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and that he will not stay his justice forever. That doesn't sound like the words of a deist. In his second inaugural address, Jefferson says that I shall need the favor of that being in whose hands we are, who led our forefathers as who led our forefathers as Israel of old, and goes on to talk about how God led Israel into a land flowing with milk and honey, and how we need to supplicate with our prayers before God daily for this nation. Again, those aren't the words of a deist. Now, there are people who are going to say that people like this and the founding fathers as a whole, they didn't really believe in any of these things, but nevertheless, they would say things like this because they had to for political purposes. Well, why would they need to do this for political purposes? Well, to satisfy the masses. Okay, then you have to concede then that the masses were Christian at this time, right? Okay, so you're saying then that what this actually is a little group of intellectuals here who are completely out of touch with the thinking of the people, but they fool them by all of this Christian talk. Yeah, well, that's exactly what we mean to say. Can you prove it? Well, no. I mean, obviously we can't prove it. We just told you that they concealed it. They were secret about it. And the fact that you can't find any evidence of it is proof of what a conspiracy it was. Well, I have my own theory. My own theory is that the founding fathers were all Moonies. But they were ahead of their time, and they knew that Mooneyism wouldn't be accepted in this country at that time, so they didn't say anything about it to anybody. Can I prove it? No, I just told you they made it secret. Weren't you listening? Point of the matter is, unless you are going to start with the premise that absent some compelling motive to the contrary, people normally say what they mean and mean what they say, then objective scholarship about the founding fathers becomes impossible. And I prefer to take them at their word. Well, look to some of the others, the vast majority who clearly were professing Christians. And one man I'm going to begin with, the only clergyman who was in Congress when the Declaration of Independence was signed, a man by the name of John Witherspoon. Now, if we talk about George Washington and all these others as the founding fathers, we would need to call John Witherspoon the founding grandfather. John Witherspoon was raised in Scotland. He was a Presbyterian preacher in Scotland. There was a conflict between the evangelical and the liberal wing of the Presbyterian Church in Scotland, and he emerged as the leader of the evangelical wing of the church there. And he preached a sermon in 1757 that was titled, "The Absolute Necessity of Salvation Through Christ," in which he clearly set forth the gospel of salvation. And He was criticized by some for being too harsh in this message, and so he preached a subsequent message. The subsequent message was titled, Inquiry in the Scripture Meaning of Charity. People were saying he wasn't very charitable in what he was saying about nobody can get to heaven without Christ. So an inquiry into the scriptural meaning of charity. And he said, true charity includes an ardent and unfeigned love to others and a desire for their welfare, temporal and eternal. And that charity requires, in his words, the deepest concern for their dangerous state. And that one who is unconcerned about the souls of the lost does not really possess charity. Well, words of that sermon made their way to the United States, who were the colonies at that time, of course. And a little school in New Jersey, first called the Log College and then known as the College of New Jersey, and it's changed its name now to, what was it, some Princeton or something like that you may have heard of. But he became president of this college. Served as president for 26 years. During those years, he had probably an average of about 20 students in each graduating class. He lived on campus with them. He would get up at 5 in the morning and drill them in Bible and theology, as well as law and political science and rhetoric, 5 in the morning, every morning, just like Andy does with his students there, right? But anyway, these students went on to become many of the leading people of America in that day. During that period of time of 26 years, there were some 478 graduates. 114 of them became pastors. 13 became governors of various states. 3 were U.S. Supreme Court judges, justices. 20 of them became United States senators. 33 congressmen, 1 became vice president, and that's one that is a mixed bag, Aaron Burr. And Aaron Burr is a mixed bag. I mean, there is an Aaron Burr society in America today that is devoted to his memory, and I look at him as more of a villain than a good guy, but he has his side of things too. In fact, his father was a Presbyterian pastor and a president of the College of New Jersey. And out of those delegates to the Constitutional Convention, 9 were Princeton graduates, and at least 6 of them, and possibly more, had studied under Witherspoon. One of them, James Madison, became our 4th president, and we often refer to him as the father of the Constitution. Now, one of the things that Witherspoon especially impressed upon them was the depravity of human nature. And because of that, the need to restrain government power. And he talked about the separation of powers, and he had studied carefully the works of Montesquieu especially, and shared with him Montesquieu's concept of separation of powers, but he added something that went beyond Montesquieu, and that was the need for checks and balances so that each of these branches would limit the power of the others. All of these were things that Witherspoon shared with his students. Now, one of these, as I mentioned in particular, James Madison, went on to become the 4th president and was one of the most influential delegates to the convention, so much so that some will call him the father of the Constitution. Personally, I think that term is a little strong. There are others who certainly deserve a great deal of credit at the convention too, but Madison is the author of the notes that give us most of our information of what went on at the convention. Madison had first come to Princeton with the idea of studying for the ministry. Never actually told us why he did not go into the ministry. In fact, he had suggested to friends that they should go into ministry, and he said at one point, if I felt myself called, that's where I would go, and that is the highest calling one could possibly make. But he stayed there at Princeton a full semester after graduation so he could study Hebrew. I'm sorry, it'll be better tomorrow. And he could read the Hebrew laws in the original language. It's amazing how quick people could learn back in those days and the degree of learning. In fact, it wasn't at all uncommon for people in those days to know several languages and know them well. In fact, to be admitted as an undergraduate freshman at William & Mary College in those days, you had to be able to read and write and converse and debate in Greek. And that's to get in as an undergraduate freshman. I don't think my seminary Greek professor could debate in Greek. And I had 18 hours of Greek, and I know I couldn't. But consider the influence that someone like John Witherspoon had upon those delegates. He was not at the convention, but John Adams, in fact, stopped to listen to Witherspoon's preaching as he was on the way to Philadelphia, talked about his sermon and how sensible it was. As he was serving in Congress with him, one time he writes back to his wife Abigail that heard Reverend Witherspoon preach today, an excellent, sensible sermon, and went on to say, "Now that I have served in Congress with the doctor, I find I understand him better." And I thought that meant because Witherspoon was so deep in what he was saying. Actually, it's because he had such a Scottish brogue that a New Englander like Adams would have a little difficulty understanding it. But let's move on to a few others. George Washington. I've heard people say that Washington was a deist, and I have a standing offer of $1,000. Did I wake anybody up with that? $1,000 to anybody who can produce any authentic statement of Washington in which he either denies any doctrine of the Christian faith or in which he ever claims to be a deist. I've been making that offer for 20-some years, and nobody has found it yet. Washington was regular in church attendance. He was a vestryman in the Episcopal Church, and to take office as a vestryman, he had to swear under oath that he accepted the doctrine of the Episcopal Church, which at that time included not only the Apostles' Creed and the Nicene Creed and the authority of Scripture, but also, at that time, the 39 Articles of Calvinism as well. Now, if Washington was a deist, he committed perjury when he signed that oath. And the evidence that he didn't believe those things is absolutely non-existent. Washington was not particularly demonstrative about his faith. He kind of saw himself as a spokesman for the whole nation, and that being the case, he didn't think it was wise that he should engulf himself in doctrinal matters. But when on rare occasions he would do so, he clearly came down on the side of Orthodox Christianity. On one time, when he resigned as general of the army at the close of the war and with the intention of going back to make an honest living farming for the rest of his life, he wrote a letter to be circulated to the 13 governors in which he referred to Jesus Christ as the divine author of our blessed religion. Henry Cabot Lodge said of that statement that either Washington believed in the divinity of Christ, or when he wrote those words, he deliberately stated something he did not believe. On another occasion, he spoke to the Delaware chiefs and said to them, "You would be wise to adopt the religion of Jesus Christ. It will make you a wiser and happier people than you are now." The few statements that you see from Washington where he does delve into doctrine clearly show that he himself believed in the Christian faith, and there is no evidence to the contrary. Now, of all the things that Washington ever said and wrote, probably none is more worthy of quotation or memory today than that farewell address. A marvelous address. And it is likely that Alexander Hamilton had a major hand in the writing of that address. And Hamilton was raised a Calvinist To give you a little of Hamilton's background, he had some problems during his lifetime. You could say that if there's one lesson to see out of Hamilton, it's the need for a consistent walk with the Lord throughout your life. He had a great start, and in some ways a dramatic, if not great, finish. In between, he faltered some. But he was born on the island of Nevis in the West Indies, an illegitimate child. His mother sent him to a Jewish school where he learned the Ten Commandments in the Hebrew language. He had a couple of teachers as a child. One was the Reverend Hugh Knox, who taught him in Scottish Calvinism. The other was a businessman, Henry Kruger. And from Henry Kruger, he learned business. And there is a Dutch Calvinist for him. But at the age of 12, he began working for Kruger in this international shipping business. And when Kruger had to go to the continent for a while to recover from a lengthy illness, he left this 14-year-old boy at this time, Alexander Hamilton, in charge of an international shipping business. Here he is dealing with pirates and lawyers, and I don't know why I put those in the same breath. And I humbly apologize to any pirates I've offended by doing that. But also during this time, there was a great hurricane, and here is a letter that he writes to his father in Scotland. And he had regular contact with his father, even though he was illegitimate. But ask yourself, how many 14-year-old boys do you know who could write a letter like this? He begins, "Honored sir," that would disqualify a lot of kids today, I think. "I take up my pen just to give you an imperfect account of the most dreadful hurricane that memory or any records whatever can trace. My reflections and feelings on this frightful and melancholy occasion are set forth in the following self-discourse. Where now, O vile worm, is all thy boasted fortitude and resolution? What has become of thine arrogance and self-sufficiency? Why dost thou tremble and stand aghast? How humble, how helpless, how contemptible you now appear. And for why? The jarring of the elements, the discord of clouds? O impetuous, presumptuous fool, how darest thou offend that omnipotence, whose nod alone were sufficient to quell the destruction that hovers over thee, or crush thee into atoms? See thy wretched, helpless state, and learn to know thyself. Despise thyself, and adore thy God." That's Alexander Hamilton at age 14. It is Hamilton who stands up at the Constitutional Convention and says, "Take mankind in general, they are vicious. Their passions may be operated upon." He goes on to say that until the millennium comes, in spite of all his vaunted pride and goodness, hypocrisy and treachery will continue to be the most successful commodities in the political market. Not long before Hamilton died, he laid plans to establish an organization that he thought could preserve the values this nation needed, and he wanted to call his organization, it wasn't Americans United for Separation of Church and State. It was the Christian Constitutional Society. But as many of you will remember, he died in a duel with Aaron Burr, and he would not recommend dueling today, I feel quite certain. But by the way, dueling at the time, it isn't just two macho guys out there trying to duke it out. Rather, at the time, when someone had said something that really compromised your honor, challenging that person to a duel was your way of saying, "I value my honor so highly that I am willing to risk it on the field," rather than compromise it in any way. And very seldom when somebody challenged another to a duel, did a duel ever take place. Usually, friends would intercede and they'd work out a carefully worded retraction or apology or whatever was needed, and they'd take care of it that way. But in this case, that couldn't be done. And so, they had to cross the river and have their duel. Now, the reason they had it in New Jersey instead of New York was that Hamilton had authored a bill that made dueling illegal in New York. But anyway, he was so convinced that dueling was wrong, but also so convinced that if he backed out of this, he'd be acknowledging that what he'd said about Burr was false, and he insisted it was true. And so he determined that he was going to face Burr in the duel and refuse to shoot, which was not unheard of in duels at the time. And many times neither party would shoot when he found out the other one wasn't going to. But anyway, he wrote that to several people, and here's what he wrote to his wife the night before the duel. He wrote, "The scruples of a Christian have determined me to expose my own life to any extent rather than subject myself to the guilt of taking another. This much increases my hazards and redoubles my pangs for you. But you would rather I should die innocent than live guilty. Heaven can preserve me, and I humbly hope will. But in the contrary event, I charge you to remember that you are a Christian. God's will be done. The will of a merciful God must be good. Once more, adieu, my darling, darling wife. Alexander Hamilton." Well, the next morning, they faced each other in the duel. What happened took place in a split second, and pretty hard to say exactly, but there seemed to be general agreement that Burr's pistol fired first. Hamilton was struck. Hamilton's pistol then fired, but the shot went wild. Very possibly his finger just clenched on the trigger as he was struck. Very shortly after that, he declared, "I fear this wound is mortal." He lingered on for 31 hours. Shortly before he died, he took communion. And as he took communion, he said, "I have a tender reliance on the mercy of the Almighty through the merits of the Lord Jesus Christ." I think it's pretty hard to find a clearer profession of salvation than that. As I look at all of the founding fathers, possibly my favorite is John Jay. Now, John Jay will go down in history for many reasons, as the chief negotiator of Jay's treaty with England, for example, as a member of the Continental Congress and a signer of the Declaration of Independence. He'll go down as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of New York, go down as the first Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. And by the way, he had a regular practice of opening every term of the court with having a pastor come in to lead in prayer. One of the things that he's best known for also is as one of the three authors of the Federalist Papers. This is the series of essays by Jay and James Madison and Alexander Hamilton that were designed to explain the Constitution and persuade people to ratify it. It was written as a series of newspaper op-ed essays, you might say. And I always require my students in law school to read the Federalist Papers. They tell me that they're challenging and stimulating and interesting, but they've sometimes said, "This is the hardest thing I've had to read in my entire academic career." And I usually tell them, "Well, I can understand that, because they were written for a very elite audience, the farmers of colonial America." And you're going to have a hard time approaching that intellectual level, because some of you have been through 12 years of public education, and some of you have had your education still further stunted by 4 years at a state university. But if you really study hard, you might be able to pull yourself up by the bootstraps and remotely approach the level of academic sophistication of the farmers of colonial America. And some of them come close. John Jay himself, when at the age of 16, he enrolled in King's College in New York, which is now called Columbia, one of his entrance requirements — this isn't for graduation, this is to get in — was to translate the first 10 chapters of the Gospel of John from Greek into Latin. But I think John Jay will be remembered in the annals of eternity, primarily as founder and national president of the American Bible Society. And to see John Jay's expressions of Christian faith and even expressions of Christian theology, you would think that he might have graduated from Dallas Theological Seminary. I'm just going to read you a small portion of one of his addresses to the American Bible Society. This is one when he was quite old, 1824. He talked about how a great proportion of mankind are ignorant of the revealed will of God. And he said, by conveying the Bible to people thus circumstanced, we certainly do them a most interesting act of kindness. We thereby enable them to know, to learn that man was originally created and placed in a state of happiness, but becoming disobedient, was subjected to the degradation and evils which he and his posterity have since experienced. The Bible will also inform them that our gracious Creator has provided for us a Redeemer, in whom all the nations of the earth should be blessed, that this Redeemer has made atonement for the sins of the whole world, and thereby reconciling the divine justice with the divine mercy, has opened a way for our redemption and salvation, and that these inestimable benefits are the free gift and grace of God, not of our deserving, nor in our power to deserve. He describes an incident when he was in France, and in which he faced off with some of the deists and free thinkers in France. He says, I was at a large party, of which were several of that description. They spoke freely and contemptuously of religion. I took no part in the conversation. In the course of it, one of them asked me if I believed in Christ. I answered that I did and that I thanked God that I did. Nothing further passed between me and them or between any of them on that subject. Well, there's a lot more founding fathers I could talk about. I could talk about Patrick Henry in particular, and Patrick Henry is such a fascinating individual. Very possibly he was the most respected person in America at the time, with the exception of George Washington himself. But he served 6 terms as governor of Virginia. He was a strong advocate of religious liberty. In fact, on one occasion, Patrick Henry was traveling in some of the rural areas of Spotsylvania County. He had a case in the courthouse there that he was going to handle. And by the way, he was admitted to the bar at age 18 after having studied law for a total of 8 weeks. And to read some of the legal arguments that he makes at various times, it's quite incredible. But in this case, as he comes into the courtroom, he sees what's going on before, and there are 2 Baptist ministers who are on trial for having preached without having a license from the Church of England. Now, this was a matter of principle with them. And in fact, at that time, if you accepted licensure from the Church of England and tacked the word Episcopal on the front of your church, you could preach Baptist doctrine or just about any doctrine you wanted to, so long as it was in some remote sense Christian. And some of them would do so, but these would not. Caesar was not going to license God. And so they were there on trial for having conducted religious services without approval from the church. Patrick Henry sat in the back, listened to a bit of that trial, and he got so upset, he stood up and said, excuse me, Your Honor, what am I hearing? Do I understand that these men are on trial for having preached the gospel of the Son of God? And he immediately asked to join the defense, lost the case because, quite frankly, the law was against him, paid their fines for them and told them to go on preaching, and he defended many Baptist pastors in similar circumstances to that. In his testimony, he his last days there, as he's dying, he gave one last witness to his doctor. His doctor wasn't a Christian, and he had shared Christ with him many times. And as he is dying, He asked his doctor to observe what a blessing the Christian religion is to a man about to die. His last words survive after him in his last will and testament, where he said, "This is all the inheritance I can leave to my dear children. The religion of Christ can give them one which will make them rich indeed." And that is the heritage that the founding fathers leave with us, the religion of Christ and the Christian principles of law and government that we will be talking about tomorrow. Now, the Bible is not primarily a Christian, or is not primarily a political textbook. But it does talk about politics. It does talk about law. And when it does, it is just as relevant and it is just as infallible as when it talks about anything else. And we will see many of those principles from God's Word and see how they come to become part of our system of government as we address these issues in further detail tomorrow morning. Well, right now, if that clock is correct, it's 9:20, and we have 10 minutes until closing time. So let me devote a little of the time here to question and answer. And I was really looking forward to this because I had a lot of questions that I want to ask you. But I guess this isn't law school, so it doesn't work that way. Okay?
If you have a question you'd like to ask,
there's one right
just,
over here.
Go ahead and
there's
raise
one right
hand.
Here. If you...
There we go. Let me come around. Pass that mic down.
Yes, I've heard it said that there were atheists among our founding fathers. Have you any evidence to the support that or contrary to that?
Atheists among our founding fathers? I'm sure there were atheists in the country at that time. Among any that would be considered a founding father of any influence, I would know of none. Even Tom Paine. Now, interestingly enough, you know, I'll talk a little bit probably about Tom Paine tomorrow morning, but Tom Paine probably was not an Orthodox Christian. But if you read some of his earlier pamphlets, and I would have to say about Paine that he and Jefferson were probably the two most gifted writers of America at that time, but he repeatedly invokes the Old Testament as the basis for his claim that America should be independent and presents a very convincing case out of the Old Testament, probably a better one than probably most preachers today could make. Now, whether he believed that or not, I don't know. And at no time, though, did Tom Paine ever embrace atheism. At all times, even when he had gone to France and got in trouble even in the French Revolution there, that even in those days, he always affirmed his belief in God. I don't know of any. Now, Ethan Allen of Vermont was definitely not an Orthodox Christian in any sense of the term. There is a story circulating that in his last days he wrote that he had been mistaken all this time and that he came back to Christ in those days. I think there's some doubt about that, but I hope I'm wrong. In fact, Ezra Stiles, at the time Ethan Allen died, he backdated an entry in his diary saying, "Today Ethan Allen died and went to hell." But Allen probably was something like a deist, maybe, or possibly Unitarian. He wrote a short book that was titled Reason, the Only Oracle of Man. So you can see where he's going with that. But again, you couldn't call either of those men really leading founding fathers. Paine, neither of them really ever held public office. I don't think you could find many that we called deists, and among atheists, I don't know of any.
So how would you define what a founding father is?
Well, I guess the sense that every person in America at that time that had any role at all in contributing to American independence, whether it was through military or voting to ratify or anything like that, could be considered a founding father. I would call the important founding fathers, the leading founding fathers, would be those in the Continental Congress that voted for and signed the Declaration of Independence, and those that signed the Petition of Right to England and so on, and then those delegates that signed the Constitution, those that attended the ratifying conventions of the varying states where they ratified, those are the ones that I would call leading founding fathers, but there are certainly, I mean, really, there's no fine line between who is a founding father and who isn't.
Two items for you to comment on.
Okay.
One, I'd seen a letter from Benjamin Franklin, I think, to his daughter, supposedly days before his death, where his comment was that he had a heavy reliance on God, but had, and I'm not using the right words, the exact words, but no dependence on Christ whatsoever. Supposedly was a letter written by him to his daughter. And then the other one, if you wouldn't mind commenting on, was George Washington's letter to, I guess, a king in the Middle East or whatever over piracy or whatever, where supposedly he states that America is not a Christian nation. Could you comment on this?
Sure, I'll comment on both on both of those. And first of all, as far as this letter from Franklin, I'm not sure the exact wording. I don't recall him saying he had no dependence on Christ. I do recall him saying in that letter that, telling his daughter, go constantly to church, and urging her, regardless of the truth of the Christian religion, that she'll benefit from hearing it and following it. Now, as far as what he's talking about there, the message to the Dey of Tripoli in regard to whether or not the United States is a Christian nation, first of all, there was a copy of the treaty that supposedly bore Washington's signature, and I don't think there's anyone today who will deny that's simply false, that the treaty didn't even get drafted until after Washington was no longer president. And the treaty itself, in fact, bears Adams' signature. And what had happened to this treaty, you need to get a little background on this first. We're dealing with the Barbary states. They're the states off the north coast of Africa and the Mediterranean who had a practice of piracy where they would seize European and American vessels and take those on them as captives and many times sell them into slavery at various places in the Middle East. In fact, Jefferson had an encounter with them in the early 1780s when he was in England. He and John Adams met with the ambassador from, I believe it was Tripoli, it might have been, well, Algiers, one of the two. And anyway, the European nations were paying tribute to the Barbary states, and they were pretty faithful about it. You pay the tribute, and we'll leave you alone. We'll leave your ships alone. Well, anyway, so Jefferson asked the ambassador, how can the United States have good relations with the Barbary states? And the ambassador, oh, we want good relations with you. We are all for good relations with you. You pay the tribute, and you will have good relations with us, and we will not bother you in any way. And Jefferson asked, what has the United States ever done to offend you? And his answer was, all non-Muslim nations are at war with Allah, and therefore we have a right to deal with them in any way we see fit. Well, Jefferson didn't seem to be very persuaded by that, but for the next couple of decades, the United States actually paid about $1 million a year in tribute to the Barbary states, which doesn't sound like a whole lot of money until you realize that it was about 20% of our total budget. And then when Jefferson became president in 1801, he stopped the tribute, and that's when the saying arose, millions for defense, but not 1 cent for tribute. The Barbary states immediately declared war on the United States. Jefferson sent the Marines to the shores of Tripoli, and well, you know the rest of that. But the Treaty of Tripoli that was negotiated just before 1800 and then ultimately signed by Adams, it has a statement in it to the effect that the United States is not in any sense of the word a Christian nation. And that is listed in there as Article 13. Now, what is strange about this is when you read the Arabic version of the treaty, that whole article, that whole phrase is not even in there. And the suggestion on this that makes the most sense to me, and by the way, I've got an appendix here where I deal with it, I found out more since that time, but we talk about it there. But anyway, and it appears that what this originally was a note from the Dey of Algiers to the Pasha of Tripoli, telling him that it is okay for you to enter into a treaty with the United States because the United States is not a Christian nation. And based on that, they went ahead and entered into the treaty. But as I say, that doesn't appear to have been part of their version of it. And what is so interesting about it is when the treaty was renegotiated and renewed under Jefferson, that whole phrase is not in there, indicating that it was some kind of an aberration. Now, here's something that when people quote the Treaty of Tripoli, there's something that they don't cite, and that is the Treaty of Paris. Treaty of Paris of 1783 is truly a founding document of this nation because that is the treaty by which England recognized American independence. It was negotiated on our side by John Jay and Benjamin Franklin and John Adams. And the treaty begins with the words, "In the name of the most holy and undivided Trinity." And that, there is no question of the authenticity of that. And that, as I say, is a basic founding document of the nation because that's what seals our independence. So I would place a lot more weight in that than in what I consider to be a bogus phrase in the Treaty of Tripoli. And there is disagreement about whether it's legitimate. I don't think there's any disagreement that the copy that supposedly had Washington's signature is bogus entirely. Others? Well, it is 9. We'll take one. It's 9:30. We'll take this as the last one for tonight then.
My question is somewhat related to your comments about the Muslim Barbary pirates and their attack on our merchant ships. A while back I heard someone say that one of our founding fathers was a Muslim, but he was led to the Lord by Francis Scott Key, and I have forgotten the name of that convert. Do you know who that might be?
I don't know who that was. Just to repeat the question, he's saying that he has heard that there was a Muslim American who was led to Christianity by Francis Scott Key, who, of course, was the author of the Star-Spangled Banner, also the author of many fine Christian hymns. No, I'm not aware of that. However, at home, I've got a book, one of the many books on my shelf that I haven't read yet, a biography of Francis Scott Key, and when I get home, I'm going to check that and see what I can find out, and if I'm able to find anything out on that, I'll communicate it to Andy.
Okay. All right, well, this time I'm going to close us in a word of prayer, and let's put our hands together for John Eidsmo for that fantastic information.
Thank you.